Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer. Today, joined by Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
Hi, Nicholas. How are you?
I am pretty good. Pretty good. I'm also joined today by Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Doing very well, thank you.
So let's get into it. And we don't usually start with a tweet, but I thought that this is a tweet not just worth talking about, but putting at the front of our show. And this is because it is a tweet from Fikile Mbalula, the Secretary General of the ANC, which says something about the kind of soul-searching, I think, that's going on inside the ANC. So the ANC has, you know, been in alliance with the Communist Party for many decades. The ANC has attended many socialist conferences around the world. The ANC has enacted policies in South Africa that we can, at the very least, say are left of center, if not far left. And yet, it seems as though there are some in the ANC who have decided that it is finally time, perhaps with the GNU, to push the party in a slightly different direction. Let me read Fikile Mbalula's tweet here. It's not exactly super clear what he means, but I think it is worth talking about. Fikile was, and it looks from the context, I think he was basically responding to things that the Communist Party had been saying about the ANC going into alliance with the DA and the GNU. He said, "The ANC is neither a capitalist or a socialist party. Our relationship with capital is unity and struggle of the opposite. We are a multi-ideological party at best. You can say we are social democrats. The burden to advance the struggle for socialism is on the South African Communist Party. Insults and insurrectionary phrase mongering will not change the ideological outlook of the ANC." Now, clearly, Mr. Mbalula has been a fan of the Daily Friend Show because I've been banging on for the past couple of weeks that the ANC should reform itself into a social democratic party. But yeah, that may not be the case. But I also am very fond of this phrase, insurrectionary phrase mongering, which is such a great term. But Terence, what do you make of this? I mean, this is, I think, interesting. It doesn't really tell us much concrete about, you know, whether the ANC is actually going to approach government significantly differently. But it does suggest to me it's another sort of signpost on the road that seems to say things may be going in a slightly different direction, or at least there's a battle within the ANC to maybe turn things in a slightly different direction. What do you make of this, Terence?
Well, I think, first of all, the ANC has always kind of, certainly since the 1990s, has kind of defined itself as a broad church. It uses various terminology to define this. You know, it's a party of all race groups, and it's a parliament of the people, and you know, it represents the poor and the middle class and even the wealthy to some extent, etc., etc. Yeah, you know, I think that while it was the you know, the top dog in town electorally, it could sort of get away with this because everyone had to play nice with it in order to get their slice of the pie. I think now things are looking different, and it has to start making some hard choices. Now, you know, technically, if you had to put the ANC in some sort of box, it would probably say say center left. It's a member of Socialist International, which tends to be the sort of social democratic parties. So Labour in Britain or the SPD in Germany are there. But then it's also extremely chummy with the Chinese Communist Party, a party, incidentally, it didn't have a great deal to do with, you know, prior to the 1990s. Just saying. It doesn't have that sort of party-to-party relationship with the Labour Party in Britain, for instance. I suspect to a large extent, the ANC has fused itself with the state. Now that it has to share the state, it's trying to hold on to its. It's sort of defaulting to what it's become accustomed to, and if uppity people in its alliance want to be ideological purists, that starts to look very threatening. It was all great fun when you could roll this insurrectionist phraseology out, at a party conference in 2009, knowing that you're probably coming back with a handsome majority in the next election. Now that you're not, the world just looks very different. And I think this is, well, a signpost along the road that says that we are having to realize that the world is different. I don't think we've quite got to the question of how we deal with that, but yeah, that things look different is now becoming increasingly apparent. I am incidentally reminded of something Nelson Mandela said back in 1996, speaking of the Communist Party, that privatization is the fundamental policy of the ANC, and we're not going to change it because of your pressure. Remember, this was also a time when the ANC was having to adjust. First of all, there was no Soviet Union. Secondly, they'd just taken over the government, and I think to a large extent they were kind of looking around saying, "Okay, what the hell do we do with this thing now?" When you're sitting behind the president's desk, the world looks very different.
I see. I actually just did a quick internet search for phrase mongering, and I see that apparently Lenin in 1917 wrote an article called The Harm of Phrase Mongering. So that's quite interesting. But anyway, Chris, what do you make of this? I mean, it does seem like Fikile has become in some way sort of the standard bearer for promoting the ANC to move in a different direction, ideologically, at least in rhetorical terms. I'm not sure whether the ANC is, even the Fikile ANC has fully onboarded precisely what this means giving up. But it does seem that, I mean, he's been saying other things as well, like, for example, that the ANC can't strut around like peacocks, I think was his other phrase, pretending like we won this election when we didn't. I think the next internal ANC conference is going to be very interesting because if people like Vukile are returned to power, the ANC may continue on a course of deviation from the last sort of, 20 years of governance or 15 years of governance.
Yeah, I think for parties such as the EFF and MK, having now sort of ruled themselves out of being in the government of national unity through their own choices and ways of negotiating, they're now playing maybe that somewhat medium to longer term game towards the next ANC elective conference to see exactly, is it more, relatively more sort of ideological hardliners, pragmatists? Maybe in a positive and unfortunately negative sense, where they're very willing in who they get into the party. So you see MK just bringing pretty much everyone on board now. Maybe then, should the ANC become more and more desperate, they could be open to those sorts of individuals returning to the fold in the ANC as well. So that's one consideration. I think for Mbalula specifically, and for the ANC, if you experienced as a party a 17 percentage point drop from 2019 to 2024. That, for you as individuals in the NEC, in the leadership, or in the party, in the sort of structures that actually have to carry out the day-to-day work, that brings about questions whether your leadership is adequate, their ideological choices, their management choices, all of that sort of stuff. Now, where do you find those answers? Is it now possibly with some of your somewhat more centrist, more pragmatic coalition partners in the government of national unity? Or do you think the ANC has sort of lost its way and a party like MK could restore it to maybe what it ought to be, kind of thing? So these questions, I think, are percolating for many in the background. Day to day, they need to almost park that and figure we're still part of government. We have access to state resources. Let's continue to play these games, because Mbalula's comments as well, they help to again further a little bit the idea that there are reformers and centrists in the party and those who just want to, nationalize the Reserve Bank. So let's work with people like Fikile Mbalula. He's more sensible. So it adds a bit of a veneer of respectability. The ANC can be saved, all that sort of stuff. We've seen the sort of play between the two in the past, where some will say very radical things. Minister of Health Motsoaledi in the last 2 weeks, the NHI is going full steam ahead, whether it means the end of the GNU or not. And then you have these more quote-unquote sensible comments from Fikile Mbalula. So it helps you as the ANC also portray a little bit this perception that you're more sensible. But I think we should also not fall for the maybe the trick that there's or the narrative that there's strong coherence behind the scenes, that this is the strategy you know, we're trying to create. Perceptions, et cetera, et cetera. I genuinely think there's a bit of a crisis of confidence in the party. And someone like Mbalula, like him or hate him, generally you're going to, what you see is what you get. You won't like what you get, but there's a reality to him, as it were.
No, exactly. I think that there is actually a fair amount of incoherence in the ANC. And it's not just, there isn't like a sort of clear dividing line in the ANC, like on this side, people who are in favor of the GNU, and on this side, you know, who are all moderates and reformers, and on this side, radicals who are all against the GNU. It's actually much more complicated than that. I mean, recently we had this article written by Minister of Human Settlements, Kubuye, who basically said, no, the GNU is like Lenin's new economic plan or the Chinese Long March. And she made these kind of very explicit sort of communist ideological talking points to make the case for why the ANC should engage in the GNU. There's others who have basically said that the GNU is necessary to implement the National Democratic Revolution. So, you know, the ANC really does seem in this kind of incoherent place where it doesn't really know what to do next. Maybe double down on the communism, maybe take some sort of strategic pause, or maybe, and this is what Fikile seems to be suggesting here, take a different road altogether. Any final thoughts from you, Terence?
Well, I think that one can go back to the earlier years of post-apartheid South Africa. Thabo Mbeki was quite skillful in doing this sort of thing. He was able to explain things like the gear policy in what Jeremy Cronin termed a Marxist metaphysics. And I think that for a party that does have certain intellectual pretensions, these things matter, the mode of presentation. I think it's also important to bear in mind that at that point, the ANC was kind of, wasn't a come one, come all mode. Remember some of the chaps who got into cabinet had very checkered histories, Stella Sakau and roots in the independent Transkei. In fact, there was a wonderful quote when Transkei took its independence that they were liberating all these black people from white supremacy. Yeah, you know, it's interesting. They were interesting and colorful characters. And I imagine that we are likely to see many more interesting and colorful characters with some surprising ideas crawling out of the woodwork in the years to come.
Indeed. But it is, once again, I think, important to remember that the ANC in 2004 was a party of 70%. And today, yeah, the ANC is a party of 40%. Even if you add MK and the EFF back into that pool, you don't get 70% of the vote. So there has just genuinely the political landscape has slid in a different direction. But okay, let's move on to our next topic. And this is based off of some reporting done in the Daily Maverick, which confirms, I think, in many ways, a lot of the things we have been saying at the Institute of Race Relations, in particular what Terence has been saying about land reform and expropriation in this country. So the Daily Maverick did this thing where they looked at South Africa's formal land claim process, and they went to essentially visit a number of farms around the country which had been expropriated with compensation from various farmers and then essentially given to communities in the hope that these could become new flourishing ventures. And the ones they visited, not so much. The story says, yet 3 decades after the formal land claims process began in 1996, many of these projects are floundering or have collapsed, raising questions about the extent to which billions of rands of state expenditure has benefited the claimant communities. At Dawn Valley Farm in Kolbo, a vegetable farm and game ranch purchased by the government in 2008 for 13 million rand, or just under 13 million rand, there is little evidence of significant crop cultivation. Instead, large parts of this farm are reverting to indigenous thornbush. A nearby game lodge has been burnt to the ground, and most of the large antelope and other wildlife species have been hunted out. Further south, near Umzimkulu, there's another 1,500 hectares of land at the old Highlands farm that's mostly unused. The land was expropriated originally actually by the apartheid government in 1967, but then was given essentially over to the government and was eventually handed over to a local community. In 2006, a maize milling factory was built on the land with government funding, but residents report that it only lasted a few months because insufficient maize volumes were being produced on the former commercial farm. Steel components from the milling mill were basically then all just taken and sold for scrap. The descendant of the guy whose family owned the farm back in 1967 said, the former farm workers and residents appear to have derived few lasting benefits either from the initial expropriation or the subsequent government initiatives to return the land to productivity. This is probably the oldest land reform project in South Africa, he said, but the people have got nothing out of it. People who were interviewed by the Daily Maverick said that there was a lot of sort of confusion and dodgy dealings that went on with all of these land deals. There was certain amounts of money promised to the communities, which would then be mysteriously reduced, or a small group of people would essentially take control of the assets, make money off of them, and then leave everyone else. In some places where people did genuinely try to farm, there were fights over, you know, who was in charge, because there was a sort of collective land ownership thing going on. In other places, the government didn't provide these farmers with a lot of support. And so it seems like in many of the cases, these farms have essentially kind of either fallen apart completely or turned into subsistence farms where the people working them really are not getting a lot of benefit. You know, they're able to grow a bit of food that they didn't before, but their life really hasn't changed that much. This has not been a lifting out of poverty process. Terrence, one of the things mentioned here is that in some cases, because title deeds were not given to land claimants when they were given land, they couldn't then get loans against their title deeds and then couldn't purchase the equipment and supplies needed to actually engage in farming. What do you make of all this?
Oh, various things. That's certainly one of them. If you're farming on a large enough scale, it's possible to get a lien against crops that you may have that you intend to produce. But the whole model was wrong. First of all, it was viewed as a kind of racial transfer, and that was the success metric, without adequate thought of what came next. Secondly, particularly in the early years, the stress was on, the assumption was that farm workers would be able to take over. That wasn't always feasible because, you know, a farm worker may be very skilled at driving a tractor or whatever, and I don't denigrate that skill, but managing a farm is a very different matter. And also the use of community property associations. So you would have these claims going to communities. If you're, you know, and you would have then sort of 100 people, some of whom were expecting an immediate payout. You would then have people leaving or disappearing. Decision making would grind to a halt because you couldn't get the signatures you needed, and people just lacking the experience in the background. We don't have much of an extension service. The whole plan was badly designed. You also had situations where officials would be tasked with providing support, and their kind of KPAs were based on on things that made it disadvantageous to even grant proper leases. because you know you'd sort of be held responsible if things went wrong. So you know, even some of the settlement that happened wasn't on terms that would give anybody, you know, even a smidgen of a chance to become successful. And also, there's just the view that somehow farming is easy. You know, the management of a farm is a difficult matter. You know, you see things like the game lodge that was burnt down. Well, you know, that tends to, you know, vandalism is an indicator that things are just kind of being left to drift. That they're not being used. And you know what might happen is that a vagrant might come in and, you know, start a fire, and that gets out of control, or maybe someone gets drunk and just decides to go and burn something down. But the point is that there is nobody taking responsibility for it. So it's utterly tragic. Utterly tragic.
This has been one of the points that the sort of the people who are very much in favor of expropriation without compensation, that people who are in favor of very aggressive land reform, kind of just never seem to have really come up with any kind of great answer to, other than we'll throw money at it, which is that, you know, you take land away from a farmer, whether you pay them compensation or you just, you know, take it outright. And then you give it to people. How do you give it to people? Well, we've tried to give it to people through these like sort of community mechanisms, which often don't work because they either get captured by a small group who exploits it for themselves, or everyone just fights over it and then no one kind of gets anywhere with it. Or sometimes people just end up becoming subsistence farmers. And the same state which is not able to police crime, police our borders, sort of perform almost any of its functions correctly, is now also being tasked to essentially train people up to become commercial farmers from nothing. This is, you know, it's kind of just, it's all, I think it exposes how short-sighted so much of the land reform talk in South Africa is that there really doesn't seem to be a step two, because the government has tried to capacitate farmers, but this is what happens. Someone steals the money, officials muck around, officials don't do their job properly. It turns out that farming is really hard and that a lot of people don't want to do it. This is why, after all, most people who win land claims opt to take money rather than land, because a lot of ordinary people say, well, why would I want to be a farmer when I can take the money and go live in the city and actually have a modern life? Chris, what do you make of all this?
I'll just add, because I think you both summed it up and analyzed it very well. Just the consistencies in other sectors. So this idea of throwing money at problems of the state needing to be the first port of call, but then not at the same time getting the basics right, or ensuring that there's in the legislation and the policies that there's space for the private sector to get the basics right. So you've got this in agriculture. In terms of industry, you've consistently got calls for steel, for poultry, for our automotive sector to be given other protections, subsidies, when the basics of electricity, your logistics, your ports, your rail, labor flexibility or inflexibility in our case, if those things aren't functioning, all the subsidies, all the tariffs, all the protections in the world, you're just throwing bad money after worse money, because all that support goes to accounting for those basics. You have to spend on diesel for your generator. You have to ship your goods to Mozambique or Namibia, thereby paying more because you can't ship it out of Durban. So you see it across, when you've got this idea that your enlightened bureaucrats in your big government, that they know how an economy should run, they can make all the decisions. Then when the rubber hits the road of the basics not being done, this inevitably follows. I think it's just a basic sort of economics and society 101, unfortunately. Now, question is, what lessons do you take from this? What policy changes, if any, if you, as you say, as a given politician, you really are concerned about new entrants in different markets, about more quote-unquote inclusive economic activity, job creation, all that sort of stuff? Well, I mean, do something differently. I mean, come on. You know, the evidence really is incontrovertible at this point.
Any final thoughts, Terrence?
No, I think that's pretty much it. The world is as it is, not as one would like it to be. I remember also going back to the 1990s, there was a lot of impassioned debate about what the state should do, and there were these like wonderful articles about how amazing the water quality is in Sweden because it's all state-owned. And very few people ask the question, what is the state able to do, or whether the Swedes would in fact let us use their civil service. This is kind of what we've ended up with.
No, exactly. Much more realistic approach needs to be taken with regards to all of this, if you want to actually see people's economic conditions changed. If you want to engage in some sort of fantasy of remaking the land ownership in this country, but then everyone ends up being a subsistence farmer, I don't know what to tell you because that's quite frankly an immoral and horrifying objective if you don't actually want to lift people out of poverty. Being poor on your own plot of land is not a lot of different to being really poor on a plot of land that, well, I mean, it's usually not even your own plot of land. It's usually,
Well,
still
that's the
owned by the
point.
state.
It's not yours. It's
Yeah.
probably not yours anyway.
Yeah, if it was your plot of land, you could maybe get a loan from a bank and start farming something. But anyway. Okay. Before we get stuck too much in the weeds on that one, let's very quickly talk about the summary of party political funding that has come out from the IEC. I think it was either last week or over the weekend. And this it kind of, I think, shows very interesting things about South Africa's political landscape. One, more money doesn't necessarily equal more votes. In fact, more money can often have absolutely no relation to how many votes you get. And also, I think that this is once again a sign of ANC weakness. So, in the party's declared donations, Action SA got about 13 million rand, the ACDP, 240,000, the ANC, 26 million rand, Build One South Africa got about just under 13 million rand. Change Starts Now, which didn't end up actually running in the election, got about 150,000 in official donations. The Democratic Alliance got 56 million rand, 56 and a half million rand, which is much more than any other party. The EFF got 515,000 rand, which I think I'm a little bit skeptical of, because that's apparently less than the Good Party. Good is not filling entire stadiums with people all over the country. Inkatha Freedom Party, about 38 million rand. The Independent Civics Organization of South Africa, 100,000 rand. The Patriotic Alliance, 6.6 million rand. Rise Mzansi, who achieved, I believe, two seats when the final vote tally was in, got 33 million rand, out raising the ANC. The South African Rainbow Alliance, which was basically Coleen Mokgebule from Johannesburg's PEP project, got 400,000 rand. And Mkhonto Sizwe apparently only received 380,000 rand in donations, which I'm not entirely sure I believe. I suspect that there may have been some other funding sources, but that's just my speculation. Chris, what do you make of this?
Yeah, if you talk about a good return on investment, and if we assume that that is all that MK received, I mean, talk about bang for your buck. Future investments in terms of where you're going to look at for your return on your political spending, then there isn't a better one than MK, if we take it all at face value. Look, important to keep in mind here, possibly that South African politics, at least at party sort of level or from that lens, seem to fracture a bit more. But then in terms of those parties and their value offering to citizens, there wasn't then that actual connection. So the perception that maybe things are fracturing when in reality, there's still, sort of a handful of parties to whom those who still choose to vote, and it is a declining number once again, unfortunately, in this year's elections, who for whom they will turn out to vote. So we could see a little bit of a consolidation in that regard, just the number that of parties that were on the ballot, but also in terms of those who are willing to either put their own money or others' money forward and talk a big game but then not deliver it. I think often, I mean, MK is probably the best example here. So you can start a party and maybe make an impact in one election. A few have done to the level that MK has managed. But then running an actual party, the day-to-day work, contesting by elections, the longer-term sustainability of a party or a movement, you know, there's a question there around, are you willing to sort of stump up and put in the time and money for that? So let's see whether the sort of trend continues going forward or whether we now maybe just consolidate everything to 3 or 5 parties going forward.
Terence, I think what Chris said there is entirely correct. The lesson I take away from this is that it's kind of hard to start a political party, even if you have a lot of money.
Absolutely. And I would just say that I would like to look at those numbers with a slightly sharper pencil. I suspect that there were perhaps suitcases of money being transferred, which are not captured in those numbers. But yes, I think there's also a message there for a lot of people in the business community. You hear whispers of how much would it cost. Well, you know, you just don't get to buy your favorite party. Also, I must say, I do remember Jacob Zuma once saying when he was president, "I've always said a wise businessman will invest in the ANC." Well, apparently the return on investment in the ANC these days isn't so great, but the return on investment in his party is out of this world.
Yes. I suspect that particularly in the case of the EFF and MK, both large parties which were able to do quite a lot of things, claiming less than R1 million of donations in the first quarter of this year. I'm a bit skeptical. But yes, that's for, I think, an intrepid investigative journalist to go and dig around and see what they can find out. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found this show interesting. And we will, of course, be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.